You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews that concern reading, writing, and publishing. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Keith Lee Morris, whose new novel is Traveler's Rest. Keith Lee Morris is the author of two previous novels, The Greyhound God and The Dart League King, which was a Barnes & Noble Discover pick. His short stories have been published in New Stories from the South, Tin House, A Public Space, New England Review, and Southern Review, which awarded him its Eudora Welty Prize in Fiction. Morris lives in South Carolina, where he is a professor of creative writing at Clemson University. His new novel, Traveler's Rest, is a chilling fable about a family marooned in a snowbound town whose grievous history intrudes on the dreamlike present. The Addisons, Julia Antonio, 10-year-old Dewey, and derelict Uncle Robbie are driving home cross-country after collecting Robbie from yet another trip to rehab. When a terrifying blizzard strikes outside the town of Goodnight, Idaho, they seek refuge at the Traveler's Rest, a formerly opulent but now crumbling and eerie hotel where the physical laws of the universe are bent. Once inside the hotel, the family is separated. As Julia and Antonio drift through the maze of the hotel's spectral interiors, struggling to make sense of the building's alluring powers, Dewey ventures outward to a secret-filled diner across the street. Meanwhile, a desperate Robbie quickly succumbs to his old vices, drifting ever further from the ones who love him most. With each passing hour, dreams and memories blur, tearing a hole in the fabric of our perceived reality and leaving the Addisons in a ceaseless search for one another. At each turn, a mysterious force prevents them from reuniting, at least until Julia is faced with an impossible choice. Can this mother save her family from the fate of becoming souvenirs, those citizens trapped forever in magnetic goodnight, or worse, from disappearing entirely? With the fearsome intensity of a ghost story, the magical spark of a fairy tale, and the emotional depth of the finest family sagas, Traveler's Rest is both a meditation on the nature of consciousness and a story of a family on the brink of survival. That was all from the publisher's blurb about the book. For my part, I will say that I found the narrative to be captivating and absolutely unique. And given the strangeness of the story, I began my conversation with Keith Lee Morris by asking about his inspiration, how he came to write Traveler's Rest. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, I should say first that I, for a long time, about 20 years, I've been writing stories based on dreams, where I'll just take a piece of an actual dream and then just kind of spin it out in the direction of a narrative and see where it goes. And the stories just kind of operate according to a dream logic. You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting about dreams is they don't operate on any kind of principle that we would think of as being real, and yet while we're in the dream, we still believe it, right?
So
the stories kind of operate on that same principle. I had never really tried to do anything beyond short story length, so this was kind of a conscious attempt to do that. It started off, though, as a novel that's going to take place on the beach. In fact, it was going to be called The Beach House. And it was going to take place in St. Simons Island, Georgia, where we vacation almost every year. And I had put in a lot of time and effort to studying, you know, I mean, astronomy. I was going to have things to do with the stars and tides and twilight and all this stuff. And then I was actually on a book tour in the Northwest, and I had a friend of mine in this small old mining town in northern Idaho who was opening a microbrewery. And I happened to be up there right at the time when the brewery was actually turning out its first kegs for the local bars up there. So I thought, well, I've got to go up to that. And a couple of friends went with me. And so we ended up there sampling the merchandise at the microbrewery. And it was late at night, and this other guy said he had the keys to this old abandoned hotel that his mother had bought to refurbish.
Oh, wow.
And he took us over there and showed us around this place, and it was completely dark, of course, and it's the middle of the night, and all we have is this flashlight to guide us through this place. And one of my friends walked into one of the guest rooms and shut the door behind him, and when the door shut, he figured out there was no doorknob on the door. He couldn't get back out. And So, I mean, right then, almost exactly right then, I thought this place is just too weird. And the novel started in my head being converted to that place instead of the beach.
Oh, that is
so fantastic. That's kind of the story behind it.
Have the friends that were with you read Traveler's Rest yet?
Well, they were supposed to have. Now, whether they actually have, I don't know. But we actually did the book launch party at the microbrewery in Wallace, Idaho, where the story is set. I didn't call it Wallace in the book, but it's based on Wallace, Idaho. So yes, they were all around for the book launch.
And I loved the name Goodnight Idaho, so that was great. I don't think it was a problem.
Yeah, I don't even remember how we came up with that exactly. You know, I mean, I was toying around with things. It was a long process of kind of naming things that went on between me, my agent, my agent's assistant, and my editor. So I'm not even sure exactly at what point we arrived at that as the name for the town.
Wow, that's great. So I want to get back to something you said in an early part of your answer, which is that you like to do a lot of writing around dreams. And I was going to ask you about dreams. A lot of the characters in this book have interesting dreams, and it's a very dreamlike story in the first place. But, you know, and you're writing... professor, so I'm curious about this. Some people say that writing about dreams is a no-no. Have you run up against that at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially at first, I had one story collection prior to this that was mostly stories based on dreams. And I remember telling a couple of other writers at one point that I was writing a story collection based on dreams and seeing them kind of, you know, glance at each other surreptitiously, you know, as if I'd just said something scandalous or ridiculous. but I kept getting the stories published, and I don't think it really matters where stories originate. I think the only reason that writers have ever said that, or that writing teachers have ever said that, really, is that, you know, I think young writers and people starting out mistake a dream for a story. Mm-hmm. A dream is not a story. It can serve as the basis for a story, or you can have a story that feels dreamlike, but you can't just take a dream and kind of slap it on the page and expect it to work as a short story. So I think as long as you steer away from that, it's actually a great place for, you know, story ideas to germinate, because our conscious mind is turned off. You know, we don't have those inhibitions while we're dreaming. So I used to keep a notebook by the bed, and when I would have a particularly vivid dream that seemed interesting, I would just force myself to wake up, turn on the light, write down a paragraph or two of what was going on in the dream, and then I would get up in the morning and kind of sit down and consider it. And, you know, sometimes it would seem like it might make a good story idea, sometimes not. But yeah, I've been doing that for a long time.
The characters in your book, the main characters, are the Addisons. Tonio is the husband, and he's driving across country with his wife, Julia, and their son, Dewey, and then also Tonio's brother, Robbie. And he's sort of the reason for the trip. They've gone to pick him up from rehab, and they're bringing him back to live with them while he tries to make a new life. And I that was a really interesting start. It started out feeling like it was going to be a road novel, actually, a little bit. And then they get kind of stuck. Anyway, so I wonder if you can talk about finding these characters, and did, you know, you're saying that originally it was going to be a beach house. Did you already know these characters when you were playing with that setting, or?
It was originally going to be, that's a good question. It was originally going to be a father, a mother, and two sons.
Okay.
And then when the story changed settings, I had another story or long story in mind that started with a character who was a drug addict disappearing from a hotel room, and nobody knew where he was. And, you know, I'm not sure. I wonder about that myself. I can't say exactly at what point it kind of turned from being two kids to being one kid and Uncle Robbie. But I liked that idea for an opening, or for that being the first thing that kind of kicks the plot off. So Robbie felt like there was a little bit of a, you know, he didn't feel completely organic at the beginning. And yet I like the idea of there being a sort of, as you point out, a little bit of an elliptical rationale for why this whole thing was happening, and that the reason for taking a trip didn't really have a whole lot to do with what ultimately happened. Robbie became a more and more interesting character to me as I figured out sort of, you know, where the story was going and what his role was in it.
Yeah. The other thing that I thought about while I was reading this is that very early on, Robbie acts quite irresponsibly, and it feels almost like, okay, he's irresponsible in this situation with this group of people. But then really each and every person makes his or her own very self-motivated decisions. And mm-hmm. Robbie's irresponsibility becomes sort of not that relevant or not that important, you know, in the larger picture. It's not all his fault anymore. You know what I mean?
I agree. And I think, you know, I really was working on the idea that each character is on his or her personal journey, their own personal journey through the novel. Mm-hmm. And one of the ideas I really wanted to be at the core of the novel is the idea that that's really true for all of us. We construct this, you know, we try as hard as we can to construct these units, a family that we can, you know, we can go through life with these people and have these kind of bonds and look out for one another and encourage one another and protect one another. But when you get right down to it, we're really all alone. You know, mm-hmm. It's an experience that each of us has to go through by ourselves, as well as with these other people and in this community. And so I wanted to create this atmosphere where they're all in the same place, they're all in the same place at the same time in some sense. And yet they're not really aware of it and are each involved in their own personal struggles. And I think Robbie's is the most obvious at the beginning. And yet as it goes along, I agree. And as, you know, we work toward the end of the novel, Robbie probably has as many redeeming qualities as any other character,
yes.
You know? And certainly, I mean, but I think his own personal journey obviously has I wouldn't call it a happy ending, but he, you know, as you learn sort of, I guess I shouldn't say that, right. But I mean, you learn something about him and learn something about himself before
Absolutely.
The book is over.
Now, I was going to ask you this question anyway, and you've sort of started to bring it up. I was wondering if you could talk about the narrative value of the fact that each of these characters ends up alone, the narrative value in separating people in a story in some way or other. Now, this is a very intense separation. Maybe not all stories have to be that intense, but I'm curious if you see that as having narrative value for a reader in the experience of reading the book.
That's a really good question. Do you mean in terms of the plot? Do you mean thematically? Do you mean just in terms of the reader's experience with the novel?
The reader's experience is what I was thinking of.
Yeah, I think it's really tough because I think, you know, readers don't want to read about characters separated from everybody else and just sort of on their own. I mean, you eliminate a lot of possibilities for dialogue. You eliminate possibilities for action and plot development that comes through two or more people interacting with one another. So I think it's a difficult position for the author to put themselves in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew from the beginning, I mean, my goal was to say, look, I want to get these people, I want to make this happen fairly quickly. I want them to get in this place and then very quickly kind of be separated and each in their own sort of positions. But I knew that carried a lot of risk with it. So you have to do things to say, well, what's going to keep the reader interested when we're not reading the typical novel where you turn the page and see a lot of quotation marks and a lot of dialogue and a lot of interaction. And certainly that's where those secondary characters came in.
Yeah.
That really at least three of the four characters have a secondary character, sometimes more than one secondary character who is kind of occupying their time and their attention. I think they all, each of them has their own unique backstory, so that I was very conscious of the idea that at a certain point in the novel, we're going to go back in time to stories from these characters' past and how they had interacted with one another prior to this time and this place. And I think also building a sense of suspense in the environment and with the mood so that the reader feels that something big is coming and that becomes a form of tension in itself. I really did want to, you know, several reviewers have pointed out, I mean, whether in a positive or a negative fashion, that the novel has a kind of mesmerizing feel to it, as if you're sort of, you know, dazed by looking into the falling snow yourself as a reader. Yeah. And I really did want to try to get that feel.
Absolutely. And I felt that the tension and the suspense that was created by separating them was, for me as a reader, more compelling than the whatever I might have felt disappointment-wise as far as them not staying together. I really was just so interested in whether they were going to find each other or who was going to find whom. And Now, do you mind if I just read a little something from the book and then we can talk about it?
Please do.
It's just a couple lines, but and it's really early in the book, and I didn't quite understand what was happening yet, but this metaphor stuck out so beautifully, and it really later came back to me. This is from the point of view of the mother, or wife, Julia, and they've just gotten to this hotel, and she said, she always found herself accepting Robbie easily, as if the things she saw in him and felt about him were true. With Tonio, she always thought there was something she was missing, as if there were another version of Tonio and of her, and even of Dewey, that didn't live somewhat happily on a quiet street in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, and that at any minute it would all just slip down like a poorly hung stage backdrop to reveal something else. When I read that, I didn't know where the book was going, and I won't ruin anything by saying where it's going, but there is a kind of secondary life behind these characters.
Right.
And that stage backdrop, that poorly hung stage backdrop, was such a beautiful metaphor for what is going on for her. And I wondered if we could talk a little bit about metaphor and coming up with an awesome metaphor that helps the reader later.
Wow. Okay. Sure.
I know that's hard.
I love that. I'm happy that you chose that that particular passage too, because I do think that's an important one, and kind of follows along with what I was saying earlier about right. I mean, that we don't we all kind of feel that way sometimes, that as we're going through life, like, wow, this could really be something else. To what degree can I trust this? To what degree am I suspicious of other people's and their motives? Even if they're people in my own family, you know, how fragile, how delicate is this whole construction, which I think that passage is trying to get at. And
right.
Yes, you know, and I don't like to think about metaphor, it's not something even when I teach my students, we don't spend a whole lot of time talking about the use of metaphors, except for really bad metaphors and how to avoid them. But I do think that in this novel, they were really important. And there's probably more than one kind of overarching metaphor, but there are also smaller things, just like you're talking about, the idea, even the idea of the stage itself comes up in various ways. The mirrors in the room, the snow globe that comes along later. So all of those things were important, and I wanted the reader to see something important, thematic, going on with those metaphors. I agree too that it seems to me like each one of them is needs to be deciphered a little bit. And again, I mean, it's one of those things I think that you run the risk of stretching the reader's imagination a little too far, or making them feel that they're getting bogged down in language that they don't quite understand, but they were certainly really important to the novel.
And I can't say that I've experienced this same thing as a reader that often, where a specific metaphor first strikes me for its creative, I don't know, germ, and then later it helps me understand what's going on. I mean, that was a pretty unique moment for me.
Well, yeah, thank you. I think that's the thing, is I think they have to have a first order of significance. They have to mean something at the moment that you read it, and then they should also have some sort of resonance. You know, it sounds like a cliche. Well, here's a bad metaphor you right now. It's like dropping a rock into a pond, right, and watching the ripples go out. But that's kind of exactly how it works. You know, there should be that immediate splash, but then it keeps sort of moving out in waves through the rest of the book.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad metaphor. I just think that's been used. Okay, the reader learns what's going on alongside the characters for quite a while, but then eventually the reader outpaces what the reader's knowledge outpaces what the characters know. And there is a certain tension in that. There's excitement in knowing something that a character does not yet know. And I wondered if we could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. That's not something I had even thought of before. But you're right. And I guess that's just kind of as you, so, you know, the novel being in third person with multiple points of view, and you keep seeing those different points of view as the reader, and you keep learning more about the characters and their situation, then that sort of naturally happens, right? Because we're able to observe the characters, and they can't observe one another. So we have the privilege of you know, having multiple views.
Right.
Yeah, I guess, and that's true. I mean, it does lead so that the reader knows that, for instance, to me, I mean, it's always, you know, to me, it's always about what do the characters want? You know, what do they want to happen? And I think that we, as readers, early on in reading a book, we get an idea in our own heads of, you know, what we want to happen or what we would think of as a positive outcome, and at the same time, what we're really afraid will happen. You know, what's the worst thing that could happen to these people?
Right.
And that's really where a lot of the excitement of reading the book happens. And so in this case, I agree that it's, since we sort of know how the characters are motivated and we know what they want and we want certain things for them, they are obstructed or helped along the way based on what the other characters happen to be doing and how, you know, whether they seem to be moving together or whether they seem to be getting further apart.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of how it works, right? I mean, you know, again, don't want to give it away, but for instance, with Dewey and his father, and there's that tension between the two of them wanting to find one another and whether they do or not, and we can see them either coming closer or getting further away.
And I also think that the meaning of the word find changes as the book goes on, you know, like finding each other. And anyway, I also don't want to give everything away. Speaking of Dewey, I loved him. I thought in some ways he was the main character of the book. He's the child. He's 11, is that correct?
10.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of odd, and he's very smart, and I loved his mix of vulnerability and courage. I also loved that he's an athlete, which, you know, I think that a lot of kids in literature that are odd and smart are not athletes.
Right.
But I wondered, when you work with a character who ends up being as multifaceted as I found Dewey to be, does that tend to come to you in a rush, or did you develop Dewey a lot in revision as you worked on this book?
Well, I tend to write pretty slowly. I think a lot about what I'm doing as I'm going along, so that, for instance, if I, you know, so let's say the first chapter where I'm really dealing with Dewey as the point of view character, when I get done writing that chapter, I'll think about it a lot before the next chapter comes along, so that that character has developed significantly for me between, you know, one sitting and the next sitting where I'm involved with that character. So I think for me, most of it happens in the first draft stage. I mean, that's not to say the book underwent a pretty huge revision, really. I mean, it was a long, difficult process, and it was a really hard book to revise. But I think that, you know, the meat of the story and the characters was there in the first draft. And I probably had a handle on Dewey before I really did on any of the other characters. I mean, he came to me probably the easiest, but I think that's partly because, you know, I don't base fictional characters on actual people. I try not to. But there was a lot of, I have two sons, and there was a lot of each of them in that character. And, you know, one of them is more intellectual, tends to think more in the ways that Dewey thinks. I mean, so one of them is maybe more representative of Dewey internally The other was just a natural athlete from the time he was a little kid and could do anything. And so it was really kind of, and I agreed, I intentionally did that because, yeah, it is, it's sort of strange that the smart kids all the time in literature are also sort of gawky and awkward, you know? Why should that be the case? And so I wanted to have this kid who was almost kind of cursed with being good at everything, you know? And that weighs on his mind a lot, and that it that becomes part of the burden that he carries in some sense. So I really did. I felt like I knew that character pretty well, pretty early on, and I got his sort of internal voice and his internal thought patterns pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me to hear that you started with the beach and came to the snow eventually. To me, the snow was so vital. I thought perhaps you used the physical nature of snow in order to kind of, you drew on it to write the book in a way. I wondered if I could just read a couple little pieces again.
Sure.
This is from, again, early in the book. The snow was everywhere, so thick it formed a screen between her, that's Julia, and the tangible world, and yet it fell so lightly that it registered as nothing more than a slight coldness on her face and hands. And then later in the book, another quote, the heartbeat of the world seemed almost to have stopped, the earth itself lulled into a state of hibernation by the silent, hypnotic whiteness all around, this invasion of the whole of visible space. I loved these descriptions of snow, and you already mentioned that there's a snow globe that exists in the hotel that Dewey keeps running across, and I think other people find it and hold it. Can you talk about how snow eventually affected the storyline, the narrative, as you worked?
Right. Well, it obviously changed things, right?
Yeah,
so,
right.
Very different from the beach. I mean, I guess one of the biggest problems I had was figuring out, you know, how many different ways can you describe snow, right? I don't know when they pulled off and it was the blizzard, then, and I started thinking of the action of the novel, I couldn't see the snow ever stopping. Every scene that occurred to me and that I started thinking through, there was always this backdrop of snow outside the window or, you know, snow in the street. And so I made the decision pretty early on in the novel, okay, it's not going to stop snowing. This is going to be this massive sort of historic blizzard, the likes of which nobody has ever seen before. And so then you run into this problem. I've got I have the same thing going on in terms of the setting. It's like Groundhog Day, right? Every day you wake up and the snow is falling. As a challenge, I think that actually became, it turned to an advantage in some sense, because those two passages that you read right there are from different characters.
Right.
And so, or deal with different characters. And so what I found is that I could use the snow as a way of saying something about the internal state of each of the characters, the way that they experience the snow, whether they experience it as an obstacle, whether they experience it as something comforting and dreamy and languid, has something to do with what's going on for each of them internally. I really, after a while, I think what started off as a difficulty to overcome became something that I was certainly conscious of, and that I was really becoming involved with in terms of how to use it to develop thematically. I mean, it became a thematic element in the novel as well as just setting.
Right.
But it was a lot of snow. It's like, you know, felt like after, you know, I sort of started feeling like I was Eskimo or something, or, you know, I was an Inuit, because it's like, well, 50 different words for how to 50 different descriptions of snowfall, you know?
But I was thinking, wow, you've been in the South too long. You really need to get back up to the cold.
Right. Well, that was another part was, you know, because I having to, you're right. I mean, I haven't been in the Northwest. This was actually, I went up and did a reading tour in the Northwest in January, and it did snow almost the entire time that I was up there. And in fact, I got caught in a blizzard and was forced to leave Snoqualmie Pass trying to drive across from Washington to Idaho. So, life was imitating art at that point. But it was true that it had been so long since I'd been in snow for any length of time that was part of the challenge as well, was kind of taking myself back to my own childhood and remembering, you know, standing by the window, watching the snowfall, hoping that there would be enough of it to get you out of school the next day, you know. And so that probably has something to do with the idea of channeling the past in some sense in the book, which, as you know, is another important part. But in a sense, I had to do that myself. I had to channel my own past in order to recapture that feeling of being in that place, because I'm not there that often anymore, and definitely not in those conditions.
You mentioned the different timelines in the story, and we're almost 100 pages into the novel when we realize that there's going to be another storyline from the past that converges in this same setting. That was very exciting to me when that happened. I was like, oh, wow, you know. So did you always know that this would happen, that you were going to present two different timelines in this novel?
No.
No.
In fact, I did not. That was the point where things really took off for me, because the place where it appears in the novel is pretty much a direct reflection of the time it occurred to me. Mm. I had gotten, the characters were all separated. They were each kind of off on their own little journeys. And then, you know, then it was, now what? And I did not know the answer to that question at that point. And I was on sabbatical from Clemson University, where I teach. And, you know, I had taken a semester off to finish the novel, and nothing was happening. I was sitting there twiddling my thumbs and listening to music and trying to get in the mood to write this thing, and starting to think that, you know, the university was going to take my salary back. And so I can remember exactly where I was sitting and exactly what time of day it was, and I was looking at the rain outside the window, and it was sort of a gloomy day, and all of a sudden this scene from the past kind of just appeared to me, and I saw the characters in this different time. And so at that point I realized, okay, wait a minute. Well, I the only thing I can say is that I knew something had happened in the past. I knew something had happened in the kind of distant past that had something to do with what was happening now. But it wasn't until that moment that it occurred to me that I was actually going to take the narrative back there. And from that point, once I discovered that, then the book really took off. And I had been stuck at, say, 75 pages forever. And then the last maybe 250, 300 pages worked themselves out in a matter of about 6 months.
That's really interesting.
That was the big one. That was the big realization.
There's a scene a little past that. We're back into the present day storyline, and it was really interesting to me. This was a chapter that's in Tonio's point of view, and it begins, "Ultimately, you lived and died entirely alone," which is something you said earlier about wanting the reader to have the sense that we all go through life on our own, even if we have family. Anyway, you have about three pages where Tonio is thinking about his life. He's thinking about his family. He's thinking in particular about his son. Toward the end of that, we find out that it's morning, and he's sitting in a chair in the hotel, and he's staring hard out into a world of white and wrestling with what he thought he knew about his senses. "I was in this room yesterday," he said. "That's possible," the owner, Tiffany, who was seated next to him, said. And that really struck me, because I'm three pages into this chapter, and I didn't know Tiffany was sitting there, and his appearance just sort of filled in like a paint by number. It was really very weird and kind of creepy. And I'm wondering if you can talk about creating that sense of the mysterious appearance and disappearance of reality around these people, if that's not too hard to talk about.
That might be too hard to talk about.
Okay.
I was certainly conscious of that. And right, the kind of effect that you're talking about, where you know, when I teach my creative writing students and you talk about setting, you talk about pictures in the reader's head and how, you know, that's part of the writer's job. I mean, the reader is going to do a certain amount with his or her imagination, but the writer has to, if the setting and what's around those characters is important to the author and is supposed to be important to the reader, then that's the author's job to make the reader see that. And in this book, you're right. I mean, a lot of the time, I think that's what I wanted to do, was sort of create the illusion of being, you know, this completely sort of internal moment that where the characters, again, and there's sort of that screen of snow, right? It's that there's all that, that's all there is this sort of whiteness, this snow. And then very gradually, all of a sudden, these other details come in and you realize that they've been there the entire time.
Yeah.
Whether I understood at the time that that was creepy, it's interesting that I knew I wanted that feel, and the sort of feel of the unknown. I guess that's kind of it, right? I mean, that's sort of it, really. It's what makes the book scary, if it is scary. I certainly never thought of it as a horror novel or anything like that. But
no. But
I think the unsettling part of it really is probably the idea of what you don't know, and what's unknown in those situations, and what's sort of lurking just around the corner, or what's lurking, you know, a minute from now or 10 seconds from now in some character's future. And the idea that the present moment and both time and place are very wobbly. And I was certainly aware of that, and creating that kind of illusion and that sense of moving internally and externally and having all of those things shift constantly for the characters. So that, again, I think that's, you know, I go back to the same thing. It's like it's like a long, elaborate dream that they're all caught in, because that's what happens in dreams, right? I mean, in a dream, we're one place, one second, and the next thing you know, we're someplace else with different people and experiencing something completely different. And yet we still, even though the transition between those things is impossible in terms of the way that we usually regard things, we still believe in it. We're still sucked into it. And that's exactly the feeling that I was trying to create.
Mm-hmm. A little while ago, you said something about Groundhog Day, and I have a question. I think you do an incredibly good job of maintaining your reader's engagement. I was absolutely fascinated all the way through this book, and I'm wondering how you did that, despite the kind of, I mean, there's a certain torpor about the characters' situations, that there's the snow and they're all exhausted. They seem a little drugged. There is the repetition of efforts and motions. So do you have any idea how you worked against, well, how you embraced that and also worked against it to maintain reader engagement?
Well, yeah, because there's always something has to be. There has to be something that the reader wants to know, mm-hmm. always. There has to be something that the reader wants to find out. If the reader there's nothing they're wondering about, there's no question that they have that there is sort of, you know, and there's a burning interest in, then a reader will just put down a book and wander away from it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're aware of that the whole time, and you have to, so it would be different things in different places. Again, I knew it was risky in a lot of ways, because you have long sections of the book in which there doesn't really seem to be anything overt happening, or in which the same thing kind of is happening over and over again. So then you have to say, well, it's like, all right, so let's say, for instance, that we've got two scenes where we see Dewey at the diner across the street. And in a way, he's kind of, not to give away too much, but he's in a holding pattern at this point,
right,
which in itself doesn't seem very exciting. So what do you do with that? And there's an internal exploration that's going on where the reader is finding out more about a certain aspect of his character. And for instance, to mention kind of his fugue states, which you find out a little bit about earlier in the novel, but during these sections, those things start to get explored more, and you start to find out more about them. You get more about his background. You get more about his relationship with his father and mother. Plus, you can see sort of looming there on the horizon, there's something that's beginning to happen outside the hotel as he goes across the street to this diner. So I think you can, you know, you see the seeds of this relationship that he's going to have with these two other characters, and that seems to be invested with some sort of meaning. So I think the thing is that the reader constantly has to feel like there's something out there in front of them that they're interested in, and that as they keep turning the pages, they're getting closer to learning what that thing is.
Right.
So, you try to do that in different ways. I think it's different things at different times. And with this book, sure, definitely more than any book that I'd ever written or any story that I'd ever written, that was the specific challenge, was how to do something that on the face of it in terms of plot seemed counterintuitive. But this is not the way, this is not the way a narrative is supposed to move along. It keeps kind of just circling back on itself and seeming to be stuck. And so how do you make that interesting? I mean, that was the question the whole way through.
Right. Yeah. I like that. Because I think sometimes writers will struggle with where to put, for example, backstory, where to put sort of explanatory passages.
Right.
And that's true. That made it much more interesting. And speaking of explanatory passages, I wonder if you can talk about presenting somewhat complex explanatory information at the end of a novel that demands at least some explanation, letting it unfold in prose or dialogue without just sort of listing causes and effects. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the kind of information drop, right?
Right, which is actually, as a writer, it's something I'm struggling with right now in a novel, and I thought you did it so well. You give us a lot. You don't tie it up so neatly that, that it's dissatisfying to me. There's a little bit of mystery in there. If you can just talk about a satisfying ending, in your opinion, what makes a satisfying ending?
Well, I think it can be a lot of different things, I feel like, so what I start looking for in the ending, and I don't, with this one, of course, it takes a turn that in a way requires, I won't, again, without trying to say anyway, it takes a turn that requires sort of a reorientation or a certain amount of exposition, because the readers find themselves someplace that they're not familiar with all of
right.
a sudden, right?
Right.
Yep. So then you've got the task of saying, well, right, I mean, things are winding up here. I mean, we have to find some way to draw this together, and yet I'm now obligated to do something new at the same time, which I think makes it much more difficult. It's not going to happen the same way every time. I think that it's great if you can find a way to wind things up in scene in such a way that the reader feels that all the things that need to be made clear have already been made clear, right? I think that's a great thing that can happen at the ending, is that whatever happens in that last scene, in those last moments, suddenly kind of shine a light backward over the entire novel, and the reader sees things that they haven't seen prior to that. They were there the whole time. We just didn't know what they meant, right?
Right.
But another thing to me, though, is that you're trying to, I would prefer not to have to go into expository mode at the end of a novel and kind of explain, although it's crazy that you have, I mean, some of the, of course, I don't think it's a good ending, but a novel is as fantastic as War and Peace. I mean, if you ever read, goes into just a huge, I mean, like 15, 20 page section that talks about history, and it completely gets away from the characters
right.
and the situation in the novel.
Right.
So, I mean, there are other ways to do it, but the way I always feel about it is, you've got a certain, you've kind of tossed all these balls in the air, right? You're a juggler as an author, and you're trying to keep those balls in the air, and you're trying not to drop them, but at the end of the, at the end of the story, at the end of the novel, it's like, okay, which ones do I catch? You're probably not going to catch them all in that last moment. You can't wind them all together. So which of the things that you brought into play, which of the balls that you have in the air are the ones that you want to catch in that final scene in order to wrap everything up,
Absolutely.
So I always tell my students who are having trouble, and they have a lot of trouble with endings, and to me, it's like, okay, well, look at what's available to you, right? Look at what you've created. Look at what you have sort of right there in front of your face that can be drawn together in an effective way to suggest an ending for everything else. in a way that feels, you know, whether narratively complete, thematically complete, complete in terms of character development. So I always feel like that, you know, the ending is just sort of hanging right there in front of you, and you have to be able to spot it.
Yeah, one thing, and I hope I'm not going to be so vague that people can't follow what I'm saying, but I really loved it. Toward the end, you have a character who asks, basically he's faced with a question about what he's going to do next. And instead of showing us him doing that thing or deciding not to do that thing, you give us a new setting, and you take an artifact from earlier in the book, and you let him come up against that artifact. And I just loved that. Is that too vague? you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, now you've got me wondering what's going on. I think I'm following what you're saying. In other words, that what you're presented with as the reader in the end, it eliminates the process, right? It eliminates but you see the results of the process in some sense, so that you know, without it having to tell you what the decision was and kind of how it was manifested,
Right. There was a satisfaction in seeing this character take a certain action, although it wasn't the action I was expecting to see, and it was just interesting. I enjoyed that very much.
I think that's another thing that's a little bit counterintuitive, is that you think that you think that sort of the most heightened moments with plot are the most important ones to get on the page. But I don't think that that's always true, you know, and I try to tell my students that. It's not, you don't necessarily need to see the killer going after somebody and killing them, you know, with a knife. I mean, you know the result because you see what happens before it, and then the character's not there afterward or whatever it is. I mean, that's kind of, to borrow a really bad sort of technique from horror films, but, it's not that exciting, really, to see two people, the fight or the car chase or the whatever it is kind of just becomes a blur of action at a certain point, and it's not as interesting as you think it's going to be. So sometimes the best way to deal with those things, I think, is really large plot points like that, and the sort of places where the action comes to the foreground, is to lead the reader to those places so that you can draw conclusions about what happened and then move beyond them and let the reader sort of form a bridge between what was the cause and effect of what they know took place.
Right. So stepping away from Traveler's Rest and thinking just generally about endings of novels, do you have any novels that you've read lately that you would recommend that maybe you really loved the ending or the way that it was handled?
Wow.
Or just anything that you've read lately that you enjoyed, and we can leave endings behind.
I'm reading the, like everybody else, I'm reading the Elena Ferrante novels right now.
Yeah.
But let's see, what else have I been reading?
That may be a series that has no ending at all.
Yeah, right. And we don't even know who's responsible for it. Here's somebody I would recommend that I've really been crazy about, Edith Wharton lately, of all people. I think that was partly because in reading or in working on Traveler's Rest, she was somebody that I went back and looked at to try to get the feel of the scenes in the past in some way. But I had read a couple of her novels, and, you know, House of Mirth and Age of Innocence, which are the two that people look at, and didn't know too much about her other work, and started reading some of her other novels, and they're all fantastic. I mean, she was just an amazing writer. And even the ones that I think were not, you know, not typically thought of as being her major works. I just finished a novel of hers called The Custom of the Country, which I thought was a fantastic novel, and I just haven't found a bad one yet. So she's somebody I've been reading with a lot of pleasure lately.
Great.
I'm trying to think of newer stuff. I guess I haven't been reading a lot of really new stuff. So I went back and reread Donna Tartt's The Secret History recently, and really enjoyed it the second time through as well. I guess those are some things I've been reading lately.
Yeah, it's funny. I read, I tried a while back I tried to read The Little Friend, and I didn't enjoy it very much. And then I did it again 3 years later, and I loved it. And I don't know
really?
What that's about, but yeah.
Well, so. That's the one that that was the one that seemed to be kind of an acquired taste. And
yeah.
you run into most people, even if they're Donna Tartt fans, who don't like that one so much. But I do run into a few that, I guess the true Donna Tartt connoisseurs out there who really like that novel too. And so I'm tempted to try it. I haven't read it. So.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, but it took me trying twice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
That happens a lot of times. One of my absolute favorite books of all times, Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son. I did not, the first time I read it, I thought it was kind of cheap and gimmicky and sort of in your face with violence and just missed the poetry and missed the character completely. And then everybody kept telling me I was an idiot. And I finally went back and picked it up again and thought, my God, this is the most amazing book I've ever read. So that does happen, which I also think is the reason why we should be careful about talking about how terrible we think something is first time through. Mm-hmm. Later on, you might have to eat your words.
Right. And actually, maybe trying twice is part of what the
right?
pleasure is you get to rediscover it and correct yourself.
That's true.
I want to just mention again, the book is Traveler's Rest, and the author is Keith Lee Morris. The book is published by Little Brown. Keith, thank you very much for speaking with me on Write the Book. I really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you. That was fun.
That, again, was a conversation with Keith Lee Morris. I will be posting a link on the podcast site so that you can find out more information about Keith Lee Morris and Little Brown. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the work of my guest, Keith Lee Morris. During our interview, he mentioned that he has for years been writing stories based on his dreams. I take a piece of an actual dream, spin it out in the direction of a narrative, and see where it goes, he said in our conversation. He went on to explain that dream logic doesn't operate on any principle that we would think of as being real. And yet, while we're in the dream and still asleep, we do believe it. Keeping this idea in mind and trying to work within the parameters of what he calls dream logic, try to write a story, a scene, or a poem this week, taking an actual dream as your starting point. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu, and by Advance Music, a full-line music shop offering instruments and gear, audio, video design and installation, and electronic and stringed instrument repair services. You're local, we're local. Advance, it's been all about the music for more than 30 years. Located at 75 Maple Street in Burlington and online at advancedmusicvt.com. And by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space for meetings, events, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information or come on down to the Burlington waterfront. And finally, by Vermont Developmental Disabilities Council, a board led by individuals and family members that focuses on bringing Vermonters with developmental disabilities into the heart of our communities. For more about the Vermont Developmental Disabilities Council and becoming a member, visit ddc.vermont.gov or call 888-317-2006. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at bigheavyworld.com every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. As I mentioned in the middle of the show, you can please go on iTunes and rate us. We're on the podcast page. You can also visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can access the podcast at our websites. Mine is shelaughswithoutus.com. And my co-host Gary's website is garyleemiller.com. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a guest that you'd like to see us try to interview, comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email. writethebook@gmail.com is the email address. And if you want to get involved at The Radiator, more information is available online at bigheavyworld.com. The Radiator is a volunteer-run organization with a lot of love behind it. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.